Ali, can you hear me?
I can, Tim. Yes, I know.
Oh, brilliant. How is everything, Ali?
I'm doing great, thank you. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for organising this and having me on today, and hopefully for a rich discussion about really important aspects of medicine and really trying to generate discussion and ideas. So thank you so much.
Maybe you could just start off by describing your journey, I suppose how we met as well, and where you're at the moment.
Yeah, so I'll keep it short in terms of my background. So I trained as a doctor at King's College London from 1999 to 2005, and I went pretty much straight into psychiatry, and I've been in psychiatry pretty much for about 18 odd years now. I became a consultant in forensic psychiatry in 2015. And alongside that, and I think that's really kind of helped me get to this point where we're having this conversation today, is that I've had an academic role for about 10 years at a leading medical school in London, where I've done a lot of teaching of medical students, also a lot of research, both conducting and reviewing and externally examining. And I've had this kind of joint role as an academic, but also as a clinical doctor on a 50-50 of the last 6 or 7 years. That was up to the point of the whole COVID debacle, and very specifically when the mandate for NHS workers to get the jab was announced. And I'm firmly told my seniors that I wasn't going to have this jab after having had a look into it and do my own risk assessment. I was doing a risk assessment for the safety of my patients and the public in the role that I had, but I couldn't apparently do that for myself. And they kind of gradually reduced the amount of work I could do over a period of months, kind of restricting me to the point where I said, well, you know, I'm not going to walk. If you want to get rid of me, you're going to have to sack me. There's no way I'm going to be forced to have the jab. And at the 11th hour, there was that U-turn. And with surprise, my seniors were shocked when I said, well, how on earth can you expect me to work for an institution like this that has zero integrity? You know, I'm on my way out. And they made even that quite difficult for me. But I left in April 2022, the NHS, and I've not worked in the NHS since, and I've moved into my own private practice where I take a holistic approach to treating people with mental health problems and health in general. And I guess we met in the midst of all of that COVID lockdowns and fear and horror, really, just what was happening, the unbounded science around that. And I guess looking around for like-minded individuals, there were very few people that, you know, I certainly knew in my own sphere. I think I was the only consultant in the trust on these mental health specialists in the country to leave because of the jabs and like a lonely thing. And then I then got a podcast with NHS 100 thing, and they put me in contact with Aisha Malik, who just started on Doctors for Patients UK group for doctors who are critical about critical thinking and asking questions about COVID and lockdowns and jabs. And
then you wouldn't learn to ask any questions, really.
Nothing. I mean, it's absurd. I was asking a lot of questions to the chief medical officer in the trust and the lead for research and education. And really, they just weren't getting back to me. And they reluctantly decided to meet with me. And that was a joke of a conversation. It's very defensive and very attacking. And all I wanted was a platform to ask questions within the trust, but they kind of shut that down and they just didn't let me do anything. And we had these joke of sessions run by these GPs promoting the jab. And they would have these teams meetings where they wouldn't allow anyone to ask any questions, just allow them to speak. So it was in the midst of that, we connected through the Doctors for Patients UK group alongside other brave and inquisitive doctors. And that's quite long, but I think that's the short version.
And yeah, that's great. And so it's fair to say, when you say holistic, you reduce the amount of medications and look at broader things than just treating symptoms. Is that right?
Yeah, the reality of medical training is that we get doctors who don't really know much about health. And we get doctors who can quite reliably, depending on the specialty, diagnose illness and know what drug to prescribe to reduce symptoms. And that's as good as they get. Drugs are there to reduce symptoms and don't do anything against underlying causes. Or refer to some surgical doctor to chop out whatever organ is giving you the problem. And that's pretty much what doctors do.
Doctors study medicine, don't they? So before you even start, you're going into training with the idea of giving a product to somebody to fix a problem. And there's a distinction between that and going to university to study health.
Yeah, and so it's more insidious than that because it's a type of brainwashing where, as a doctor, if something doesn't come into the remit of a drug or surgery, then it's not medicine. it's not what doctors do. So anything alternative, doctors put their nose up at it. Even if there's a ton of peer-reviewed papers, they still turn their nose up at it because that's not how you train. That's not how you condition. That's not how you program. So it's this kind of artificial ceiling that's placed upon every doctor. And some doctors, fortunately, can see through the cracks. Well, most don't, actually. Most don't. And I've been kind of one of the fortunate ones to see something through the cracks that's kind of helped me to accept, actually, the horror that I spent 6 years at medical school. Pretty much a waste, really. When you learn about health, and most of what I learned at medical school, I've forgotten because you don't use it. It's not practical. So it takes something to accept that all the time and money and effort to get a piece of paper that actually isn't what you think it is. But I think I had to learn it the hard way. I think there's a lot of clever, braver people who kind of realize that at the start and maneuvered out from it or kind of spoken up from it. But, you know, I think you had to take COVID to try and really burst out of that bubble.
One thing that was interesting with what you just said there is how you saw through the cracks. One question I've constantly asked myself since the beginning of the pandemic, how was I able to see through that? And I think it comes down to, in my case, it's generalism. From my background, is I did a computer degree, first of all, and I worked as a systems analyst, had my own company and designed software. And I've always had a brain that had a systems-orientated approach. And I think if you've got other strings to your bow, you kind of see the world from different perspectives. And it's far more difficult then for somebody to come along and try and present a story to you, because the puzzle, it's like, imagine you've got a jigsaw puzzle that's flat. Well, if you've got multiple perspectives, you sort of see it. It's like a 3D puzzle. So what someone presents you is one dimension that doesn't necessarily then fit with the other perspectives that you have. And that's the only way I can think that I've got such a different view of so much over the last couple of years than I think most doctors would have.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think we all come to this with different means. And I think for myself, in particular, when it comes to terrorism charges under the Terrorism Act 2005, I've done a number of cases where I've always insisted on looking at the raw material. So the messages, the WhatsApp messages, the Signal messages, the Telegram's messages, nothing is secure. No matter how much, end to end, you know, I've seen it all. But most of the people on terrorism charges that I've seen have been of low IQ generally. They've been from deprived backgrounds, highly vulnerable individuals who have been entrapped by security services. And it's all clear in the messages that I see that you get undercover counterterrorism police setting people up and then jumping in to save the day. And then you get the headlines on the news the following week or the following month. And then again, when the court case happens, and then again, when the sentencing happens. Seeing this, not just once, not just twice, not just three times, I was like, gosh, things aren't as they see. And so for me, when it came to the whole COVID thing, you know, I was already that way inclined of actually questioning. I can't just take things on face value. And so I was already in that place for myself personally when it came to politicians and global agendas affecting health and medicine and the principles that we hold dear. But seeing them trampled overnight, that was so powerful for me. It became an issue of personal integrity. Do you just kind of lie down, take this, or do you try and do something or speak up at the very least? So that's how I ended up here. It's not through bravery, I don't think, at all. It's not through courage. It's not through intellect. It's through a series of events I had no control over.
Yeah, I've been working on the front line in emergency medicine for 14 years now. And at least that is the setting where I think you can have evidence-based medicine. If you've broken your arm or something like that, it's a kind of one-dimensional problem in many aspects. I don't think then that necessarily applies to psychiatry. And that's probably what we can talk about next.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's complex and it's layered. So I think the first level that I would start off with as a practicing psychiatrist is used and worked with most psychiatric medications out there. There is some utility, I think, with all of them. I think if we become too dogmatic and we make too many sweeping generalizations, we miss the nuance. So certainly, I think there is a role for drugs when it comes to mental illness or psychiatric symptoms. And so I'll give an example. My own kind of personal views, if I ever become psychotic, I would more than kindly kind of request that someone prescribe me a Lanzapine. Because I've seen it help really kind of effectively with most people with psychosis, kind of in that acute phase. And I don't really see anything else that works so well in that acute phase, because psychosis is probably one of the most distressing experiences that anyone can experience on a really horrific, what is paranoia, just high levels of distress and anxiety and irritation. So I think in the short term, in acute settings, drugs can be quite effective in reducing extremes of symptoms. And that's probably the best kind of use of them. But anything in the medium to longer term, or as a preventative, like the evidence is not there, my clinical experience isn't there, and what you tend to get is more side effects rather than any particular benefit. And I think the biggest category of drugs which we really need to evaluate in terms of their utility for doing anything at all are antidepressants, which pretty much for, I would say, over 50% of any psychiatric diagnosis, there's some kind of claim or allegation that they're useful for. In reality, antidepressants used for depression, is what the name says, it kind of what they're manufactured, the evidence doesn't stack up. But clinically, you know, I don't start people on antidepressants. I haven't done so in a couple of years. What I generally do is take more people off antidepressants and to try and work on healing the root cause of their depression, improving their brain health, using supplements, using nutrition, using sleep, and other lifestyle measures. Antidepressants don't cure depression, they don't cure anxiety. And furthermore, the evidence that has come out 18 months ago, serotonin levels of people with depression showed that actually no matter on what level of your serotonin you have, either it's high or average or low, with any depression diagnosis, like, it doesn't matter. So within people with depression, these medications increase serotonin, but they could have high serotonin or average levels of serotonin or low levels of serotonin. It just doesn't stack up. The evidence is clear that depression isn't a serotonin deficiency yet. Doctors are programmed to give antidepressants because that's what these guidelines are. We outsource our intellect. We outsource our integrity to these guidelines. And really, I think antidepressants, that's the biggest problematic drug group we have in psychiatry, alongside benzodiazepines in terms of their addictive qualities. A bit difficult when it comes to antidepressant addiction, although it's difficult. It's very difficult for some people to come off antidepressants if we're content with withdrawal symptoms. But yeah, I think the problem I have the most is how liberal antidepressants are used and how they're marketed as this savior, when actually they're not.
Yeah, I was looking earlier, just in preparation of this evening's talk, a couple of articles on the BBC. This was in 2022. Nearly 500,000 more adults in England now taking antidepressants compared to the previous year, from 7.9 million in the previous 12 months up to 8.3 million. And as you say, if you look at the evidence, I was looking at the NICE guidelines earlier on, most of the studies are short-term, and there's very little evidence for long-term antidepressants.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the way the trials are designed. No one's really interested in long-term outcomes. I usually would get people to refer to the Katie trial and the Stardeep trial. There were big reviews done of tens of thousands of people, I think back around 10, 15 years ago now, probably a bit longer. And really, the upshot was that antidepressants may reduce 50% of your symptoms. Now, whatever that means meaningfully in someone's life, but this was the best outcome for antidepressants. They may reduce up to 50% of symptoms in one third of people taking. So in about 30% of people, they may reduce half of the symptoms. That's a big, massive review. So the tens of thousands of patients over many years. And that was as good as we got. And you, every time you change an antidepressant, it was less likely to be effective. And how many times have we heard people going on one antidepressant, then a second, then a third, then a fourth, then a fifth? I've read so many people who are not kind of merry-go-round. And the data just doesn't clump up. And so not only are the problems with what we define as evidence-based medicine when it comes to publications, the publication bias, the types of studies that are decided to be published, and those that are held back, and generally the ones that show no effect of drugs like antidepressants, you know, aren't published, are suppressed, often by the manufacturers because they're the ones that fund them, and they push forward various that have some effect. And in most cases, the effect size is pretty small, and it's over shorter rather than longer term. But when we have review papers that show that they're really not that effective at all, there's kind of silence. So there's this kind of cherry picking. So not only is there problems in the type of evidence base that's published, but also the one that actually gets the pension. And I think there are some kind of bigger forces and influences on doctors, on academics, because why do we ignore there is paper that shows that drugs aren't effective? And you know, Richard will probably mention something about a paper that showed a medication that was effective. So these are insidious aspects of evidence-based medicine that is manifested within medicine. So it's problematic.
Yeah, so there's a deeper problem here, isn't there? There was a very famous paper where John Ioannidis, How to Survive the Medical Misinformation Mess, and the conclusions were most clinical trials results may be misleading or not useful for patients. Most guidelines, which many clinicians rely on to guide treatment decisions, do not fully acknowledge the poor quality of data on which they are based. And most medical stories in mass media do not meet criteria for accuracy, and many stories exaggerate benefit and minimize harm. And so when I was looking through these NICE guidelines earlier for depression and looking at their 557 pages of evidence, if you just use these systems analysis principles from my computer degree, garbage in, garbage out. And if the state of evidence-based medicine is so bad, or the actual science and the capture of the regulators, then how can we hope to get good quality guidelines at the end of it?
Yeah, I mean, NICE is interesting from my own curiosity. I applied a few years back for some roles that they had on some of these panels that published these guidelines, and I looked at a couple of adverts. Both had a representative from pharma in each of the panels, and it struck me as like we're supposed to be here looking at what's best for patient outcomes. What's someone from pharma doing on this panel? And I think the reach is there, the obfuscation is there, the selection bias is there. I've got a book written in about 1987 talking about nutrients and supplementation with nutrients as a cure for depression. And in it, there's probably at least 200 to 300 references. They don't go into that calculus of NICE guideline panel discussion. I think there's gatekeepers for sure around what type of data goes in. And as you say, you know, what goes in dictates what comes out. So there are big problems. It's not finding the truth with a capital T. There are big issues with NICE. I think it's okay if people want to get together and, you know, make some recommendations and suggestions, and that's fine. If only doctors had the courage to say, okay, fine, this is a guidance coming from this group of people. Everyone has their own biases and interests, otherwise we wouldn't be doing what we do. It's the lack of conviction. It's the lack of courage. It's the outsourcing of intellect, integrity of doctors. Hold on to these guidelines as some kind of the scripture. So we can point fingers to institutions, to organizations, to pharma, but the biggest finger we have to point to ourselves of how we let down not only our profession, but more importantly, the patients and the people that put trust in us. People can do anything they want out there and they're doing it. You know, you don't have to follow it, but it's the conditioning and the programming of most doctors that they just go along with this. Oh, this is what we do. And that's why I think soon enough, most doctors will be replaced by algorithms and machines with AI. It's already happening. And the way primary care is going, where you don't see a doctor, it's all done by algorithm before you even get to see one. The doctors just can't see it.
From what I can see, they're firefighting, aren't they? So if you've got a 10-minute appointment and someone comes to you with a problem and it becomes labelled as depression, there's a lot there. When I was looking at the guidelines earlier, they were comparing lots of different papers, maybe how exercise versus yoga versus an antidepressant. But in reality, to try and compare these things one against each other isn't really fair, because it's not like a broken arm. It's a multidimensional problem, which has so many factors that you really need to have a plan in place that looks at everything, diet being central, exercise, another massive key point. If you've got symptoms of depression, then your body might be trying to tell you something. So it doesn't necessarily make sense that you should try and mask that with a pill. I mean, as you said, there is a new one. There is going to be cases where there's a role for tablets. And I suppose where I would stand is that medication should generally be a last resort. If you've tried everything you can to attack the root causes, and then if you're still not going anywhere, then fair enough.
Yeah, I would just differ slightly on that. I think we both agree that informed consent is a central pillar of doctor-patient relationship. And I think what I do, I always kind of point to the person in front of me and say, look, these are the options and these are the pros and these are the cons. What do you want to do? And I certainly don't think to rank options. Sometimes people don't have any other options and that's fine. But working together and giving the patient the choice, an informed choice, I think it's certainly where I try and work within that zone. But coming back to the point that you alluded to just before that about multifactorial versus single causes. Now, we have in science, and there's a big overlap between the way allopathic Western medicine and the prevailing views of scientific research. There's a big overlap with that. They're all focused at the moment. This is more of a recent phenomena, looking at this idea of scientific reductionism, that whatever the problem, we can reduce it down to a pathway because we're so clever. And we can be so precise that we know exactly what is happening. And if we do an intervention in that specific pathway with a drug, then we can save the day. But in reality, it doesn't work like that. I think it's part of our hubris to think that we can reduce things to such a simplistic way to give us the answers that we need. We are so complex, and brains in particular is the most complex thing, I think, known to man. I mean, we only know a bit about how it works. It's just a fraction. And so it is multifactorial. Why someone develops a depression, why someone develops an anxiety disorder, why someone becomes psychotic. But the problem with the scientific research is that they generally look at one variable at a time. They struggle. The research isn't done to say, okay, fine, let's look at, so how someone changes their diet, on top of that, does some neurofeedback on their brain, some brain training. On top of that, improves their sleep. On top of that, takes a high-dose multivitamin. On top of that, exercises 30 minutes every day. Let's take those things and see how someone does with a depression versus someone with antidepressants or nothing at all. Science doesn't work in a practical way. It doesn't work in a pragmatic way. It doesn't work in a way that's conducive to living. Because as a doctor, if I know five things work for depression, I'd want my patient to do as many of those five things as possible. Not just one, and then we'll do the second one, and then we'll do the third one. So the research doesn't reflect clinical practice, and it's limited in that way. And it's like a fundamental problem of evidence-based medicine, where it only takes generally one variable at a time. And usually those variables are drugs. And if there is any support, which there is a lot for, you mentioned yoga, exercise, high-dose multivitamins, there's a lot of evidence that show that they're equally or even more effective than antidepressants. But the emphasis isn't there. The programming in doctors, the programming in academics is not there to support these things. But if you look, it's there. Anyone can go onto PubMed and type in exercise treatment depression. The irony, we have access to more information than we've ever had. And the evidence is there, but no one's doing it. It's something to cry about. It's so tragic.
Yeah, exactly. It's this one-dimensional thinking that we were talking about earlier, and I absolutely totally agree. And that's why, fundamentally, both of us were completely disgusted by the COVID response. For me, it was initially the lockdowns. Effectively, what was happening is that people were being coerced into the worst, you shouldn't really call it an experiment, because it wasn't a very good one, was it? It was quite tragic, the collateral damage that was coming out. And I did speak out about it. I was on the radio. I got cancelled and I had to take a less prominent role just because I had my first kid 2 years ago and bills to pay, and any doctor speaking out was getting cancelled and jobs were at risk, basically. It's got to a point now where I just felt the need to speak out more, because what I see is the erosion of the fundamental values of being a doctor, which is informed consent and first do no harm. Both of those two core principles, as far as I'm concerned, have been completely thrown under the bus. And we've got ourselves in such a mess now that the narratives that have been purported in the media by the politicians, they are so out of touch with actual reality that the only thing they can do now is censor to stop objective truth coming out. And I think this is why everyone's after Elon Musk at the moment, because from what I can see, X seems to be the only platform where you can actually talk about these things.
And just on that tip, I remember distinctly having those conversations with you and quite hesitant about carrying on speaking up and just the impact of that on you and your future and your children and your family. And to get through that and to come to this point where you're hosting this event today, the first of many I have, it is an honor to be your first guest, and just how proud I am of you and your journey through that. It takes guts. It takes balls. And people have different types of balls. People like Dave Cartland has different types of balls. People are doing things in a different way.
Exactly. And I suppose just with you saying that, before we wrap up, I should ask you, how have you actually found your practice in terms of this more holistical approach that you've taken with your patients?
I mean, it's been amazing. It's been infinitely more satisfying than working in the NHS, where you're constricted in what you can do. Now, you personally, on a professional level, you see much better outcome. You empower people to address their root causes. And I'm always constantly learning, but in a meaningful, sustainable way, without relying on medication in the medium to long term. It's been such an experience, so refreshing, and had lots of good results with people in a way that I just wouldn't if I was working within the confines of the NHS. But it's not magic in a way. To get the most success with people, the people need that motivation and that desire to take the ownership of their own health. And you're there as a guide to help them with that. What I realize is that you're more limited. Don't go in saying, look, I've got all the answers. The art and the skill is how you can work with someone in the context of their life and the confines that they have in order to get results. And that's a skill, that's an art, that's something I've had to learn. I didn't really have that in a meaningful way in the 15 plus years of working in the NHS. Over the last 2-3 years of my own practice, you kind of learn and you develop that soul of medicine, which is missing in the big institutions, NHS organizations. And so it's been really an amazing experience for me, and I want to build and expand on that in whatever way possible and just try to help as many people as possible. And social media has a big kind of role in that, and we're able to access and to help people across the world and in numbers and volumes that we weren't able to before. So I'm really looking forward to what the future brings.
I think that's a really nice way to wrap up the soul of medicine. The other term I've heard brought up throughout this period is the spirit of science, and how that's really been eroded. And hopefully we can get these things back. Yeah, I just want to thank you now for coming along. It's my first time ever doing anything like this. I'm learning an absolute ton on the spot.
Well, thank you, Tim. Thank you, everyone, for turning up and putting up with us both. And Tim, I think you've done a wonderful job. I'm out of the ball, really. I could keep going, but I think we probably should
wrap it up.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I really appreciate you inviting me on here. And I look forward to your future episodes.